to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. Max Armstrong will be along in a few minutes with a commodities report. This was the week that the stock market accomplished something that only one other bull market in history has achieved. It survived to see its eighth birthday. 8 years ago that the Dow Jones Industrial Average sank to its recent low of 6,547, and on Friday, the Dow closed at 20,905. Over that period of time, the S&P 500, which is probably the best reflection of what your 401k might look like, rose 249%. Of course, you would have had to get in right at the bottom to realize that type of gain. But 8 years for this bull run, the longest bull run was from 1987 through 2000. Some of the biggest winners of this bull market, Netflix right at the top of the heap, 2,451% increase in share price. Amazon, 1,306% increase in share price over that 8 years. Starbucks, 1,249% increase in share price. And Apple, an increase of 1,071%. As for this week in the markets, stocks rose on Friday after a solid jobs report pointed to strength in the domestic economy and supported expectations that the Fed will raise interest rates next week. The Dow closed up 47 points at 20,905. The S&P was up 8 points at 2,373. And the NASDAQ was up 24 points at 5,862. For the week, all three indices were down. The Dow was off about 0.5%. The S&P 500 lost 0.44%, and the NASDAQ was down 0.15%. As for commodities, let's begin with oil, which we will talk about in length coming up. Oil skidded again on Friday, pushing prices to three-month lows as investors continued to flee bullish positions. They are worried that the OPEC-led production cuts have not yet reduced a global glut of crude. U.S. crude slumped about 9% since Tuesday's close, marking its biggest three-day decline since February of 2016. At the close on Friday, West Texas Intermediate was down 79 cents, or 1.6%, at $48.49 a barrel. Brent crude fell 91 cents, 1.7%, to $51.28. a barrel. Gold recovered late Friday in response to the jobs report that failed to meet elevated expectations, prompting a drop in the dollar and treasury yields and shored up the prospects for a Federal Reserve interest rate hike next week. Anticipation of a March increase has put gold on track for its biggest weekly loss in 4 months this week. Gold is highly sensitive to rising interest rates as these increase the opportunity cost of holding non-yielding bullion while boosting the dollar in which it is priced. Gold hit a low on Friday of $1,194, but at the end of trading, gold futures for April delivery settled at $1,201, down $1.80 for the day. Spot gold was up about 0.12% at $1,202 an ounce. Agriculture commodities at the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's begin with soybeans. Beans fell to a two-month low on Friday as the ongoing harvest of a projected record-large Brazilian soy crop threatened U.S. export prospects. Corn and wheat followed the weak trend despite a setback in the U.S. dollar. Bean futures for May delivery settled down 4.5 cents at 10.06.5 a bushel after dipping to 10.03, which was the contract's lowest since January 9th. March soybeans hit a low of 9.92¾ and settled at 9.96¼. May corn ended down 2¾ cents at 3.64¼ a bushel after touching 3.62½, the lowest since January 13th. March corn got as low as 3.56 a bushel but settled at 3.58. May wheat fell 3.5 cents to 4.40½ a bushel. March wheat got as low as 4.23¾ but settled at $4.22¾ per bushel. With oil prices breaking bad through $50 and then through $49 on Thursday and Friday, there was a lot of talk about the oil business in Houston, where CERAWeek 2016 was held. CERAWeek, spelled C-E-R-A, week, is an annual gathering of energy industry leaders and experts, government officials and policymakers, and leaders from technology, financial, and industrial communities, and energy technology innovators. So lots of people got together and talked about the future of crude oil prices. One of the people interviewed by CNBC's Brian Sullivan was Ryan Lance, ConocoPhillips CEO, talking about the question on many traders' minds, where are prices headed? Where is the bottom?
You are still cautious. You're still in the we could go lower camp. How come?
Well, I think when we look at the well-supplied world out there right now, both the unconventional revolution going on in North America, despite the OPEC deal, a lot of spare capacity sitting in OPEC, and we just look at our portfolio, what the technology and the innovation has done to reduce decline rates and what people have done to bring more oil on. Demand has been pretty good, so we watch that pretty closely, but I think it's difficult to set up a company right now betting on higher prices. You can't have prices bail out your business model. So we're thinking a lower for longer, and we're thinking you know, with a lot of volatility, so we've got to be prepared. We may see $70, $80 in the next couple of years. If we do, we're going to see $40 on the back end of it.
You think, and why? Because the cure for higher prices is higher prices?
Absolutely.
And an extra couple million barrels a day coming, by the way, not from around the world or OPEC, from
here.
The United States.
Yeah, no, I think that's the revolution that's going on here. So what we would have thought 2 or 3 years ago that would drive a million barrels a day of incremental production out of the U.S. might take $70 or $75 a barrel Brent. Today probably is $55, $60 a barrel Brent. That's what the technology and the innovation has done. And that's why we think a well-supplied world, and we got to be prepared to not only survive, but thrive.
So what are you budgeting?
Kinds of prices.
Are you budgeting in the 40s? I mean, where do you think we're going?
We're thinking, as we set our plans for the next couple of years, we're thinking in the low 50s. So
low
we're
50s.
Actually, yeah. I mean, we've done a lot of work in our company to now be able to fund the capital program and pay the dividend to the shareholders in a 50 and below environment.
Yeah.
So I think we've got some of the lowest break-even costs in the business today, and we've had to get there because we think that's a place that's going to be so important and makes you a competitive advantage.
You cut your dividend by 66%, I believe it was, over the last couple of years during the downturn. You raised it by 6% in the first quarter. You've said it's your number two priority.
Yes.
Is 53, 52, 54 buck a barrel oil enough for you to raise your dividend in the future?
Yes, it is, because what we can do is we're forging a new pathway as an independent E&P company. We're focused on free cash flow generation, focused on returns. We're trying to get down to where we can free cash flow money at as low a price as possible. And if you look at our third and fourth quarter results, and you think about where the company's at today, we're free cash flowing below $50 Brent. So what you do with that free cash flow? Well, you invest back in the company to hold production flat. You grow your dividend second. And then third, we need to repair the balance sheet. We did borrow some money last year, over the course of the last couple of years, through this downturn, in order to fund our capital programs through that. So those are our top three priorities in that order.
Okay. BAT for COP. Let's talk about the border adjusted tax, because you just gave a speech in there. You said it's not good for ConocoPhillips. Explain why it's not, what it would do to your business, and whether or not you think it will happen, Ryan.
Well, I think, you know, there may be, in fact, some portion of a border adjustment tax that might go. We're a big independent producer here in the United States. You know, the way it's constructed today would be good for our business, but we're a global producer, and on balance, it's probably, you know, neutral to slightly not as good for the company. But what I say, a pretty simple kind of view of it, is the problem with the border adjust tax today is you have industries and segments of the business that might benefit really well, and you have industries and the segments that are going to lose quite a bit. I think that disparity has to be narrowed a little bit. I don't doubt that some sort of tax might be able to come through, taxing imports and benefiting the exports, but I think you have to start to narrow that gap between the haves and the have-nots in the way the tax is currently structured. Having that kind of imbalance, yeah, I don't think is sustainable.
We have a president who has said he is pro-petroleum. We have a secretary of state who you might have heard of, runs this company called Exxon.
A little company called Exxon,
based around here. So it's a very pro-oil and gas administration, but do you see anything actually changing to benefit your industry?
Well,
a lot of talk. I know we're only 47 days in.
Yeah, and that's the big point, is we're 47 days in, but the conversations around what the Congressional Review Act has done on certain regulations, what Congress is taking up in terms of the methane rules, the Dodd-Frank 1504 rule that they put
what
a congressional act.
You're throwing numbers down, Ryan. Come
so,
on.
So, I mean, well, the point is there's I think there have been some tangible things that have helped our industry that keeps us more competitive in the global landscape, and those are really good. And that's certainly what happened with the Dodd-Frank rule. And now if they take on some of the infrastructure, they take on regulatory reform, we do tax reform, I think those are good for our industry.
You think they're going to get it done, though? They can take it on. Will they get it done?
I think they will. I actually think there's enough momentum, and there's enough silly things that happened over the last 8 years in our business that just really don't fundamentally make sense, and they don't have a cost benefit associated with them. I think they'll tackle those things, and I think we're looking forward to working
with Ryan Lance, CEO and Chairman of ConocoPhillips. A real pleasure, Ryan. Thank you so much
for
joining us. Appreciate that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Brian also spoke with Shell's CEO, Ben Van Buren.
But how much harder is it to run a company like Shell, $230 billion-plus in annual revenue, with the kind of volatility in pricing we've seen over the last couple of years?
Well, first of all, the short-term volatility, Brian, actually can be our friend as well. You know, we have one of the most competent trading businesses in the world. They actually make money off volatility. And the sort of volatility that we are seeing at the moment is, of course, very hard to understand. It's very hard for the market to actually see what is happening on the supply side. If you think of it, OPEC supply, short cycle supply from shales, long cycle supply from large deep water projects, for instance, each have their own logic, and they don't come together in a way that gives a clear price signal. So it is very difficult to figure out what's going to happen maybe next month, next year, but ultimately, we are in a long-run business, and we have to have a portfolio that is resilient at any oil price level.
Can you explain to our audience, though, how we go from 140 a barrel 6 or 7 years ago to $30 a barrel, back up to $50 a barrel, who knows where we're going ahead. How do we have these massive price swings in a commodity whose supply and demand seems to be somewhat stable,
No,
or is it
true.
Not?
No, it is. And that is, I think, one of the hardest part of our industry in the short term. If you think of it, all these price swings that you just mentioned are price swings that are being brought about by a 1% or 2% imbalance in supply and demand. So, indeed, which commodity has that sort of volatility in the near term? And ultimately, again, when you take investments like we do for 30, 40-year life, you have to be able to see through that, and you have to build a portfolio that can thrive also periodically in low oil price environments that we have seen. And that's exactly our strategy.
There's an oversupply now. I mean, we're producing so much in America. How is the price going to go up? What are we going to do?
Well, I guess the honest answer to that is we don't even know whether there's an oversupply at the moment because, again, the transparency of the market is not what it would need to be to really make these sort of assertions. We don't measure exactly what is supply and demand. We don't measure exactly what we have in oil stocks around the world. We may know what is in Cushing, but we may not know what is in China. So therefore, it's the lack of information, the lack of transparency, and the different response times of the supply chain that actually gives this somewhat ridiculous volatility that we have been seeing over the last few years.
What is your relationship with OPEC at Shell?
Well, we operate in some OPEC countries. We have no sort of commercial relationship with OPEC. We are not allowed to do this.
Does it bother you when they come out and say, well, we're going to cut production by 1.2 million barrels a day? I mean, they are less price makers than they used to be. They're not price takers. You are. They're price makers to a point. Do they have the influence they used to have?
Well, of course, as their share has shrunk a little bit, they have a smaller influence. But they're a long way off from being irrelevant. They are still a very relevant force, and they can actually have a stabilizing effect on markets if they play their role well, which is what they're trying to do. But we have no dealings with them in that
regard. You are overseeing a massive transition at Royal Dutch Shell. You bought BG, British Gas. You took a lot of heat for that. It looks like it's paying off. The deal looks like it's paying off now. This morning, you announced a divestiture, $8.5 billion. You're going to be selling all of your Canadian oil sands assets. Why the sale now? And where are you taking Shell? What is Shell going to look like in 3, 5, 10 years?
Well, you're right. The BG deal was an important deal. It wasn't without some criticism at the time. But I think everybody now agrees that this was the right deal to do at the right price, at the right time. Also, by luck, we more or less got it right to the day. Now, what we were thinking of when we were doing the deal, when we were completing the deal, was how this was going to transform the company from a portfolio perspective into really a world-class investment case. So that meant we were going to focus on those businesses where we have scale, materiality, and where we are fundamentally advantaged. So think of things like integrated gas, LNG, deep water, petrochemicals, etc. Right in the middle of that deal completion, we also came to the conclusion that oil sands didn't fit in that strategy.
Yeah.
It's a high-quality asset, but it was probably better owned by somebody else. So you know, from that day on, we have been trying to understand how could we exit it, and today is the moment that we got to.
And you're building a couple billion-dollar petrochemical plant in Pennsylvania. How many jobs are you going to be bringing to the United States?
Well, I think in the sort of construction phase, think of directly on the project, 6,000 jobs, and of course many more associated with it. Longer term, 600 high-quality paying jobs. And I think, again, the United States is our number one investment destination still. It's our number one country in terms of cash contribution as well as capital employed. So we see ourselves very much as partners of the United States in bringing energy and bringing jobs to the country.
Making jobs, they could spend money in Landry's restaurants. We're perfectly vertically integrated.
But never with cigars and $20 bills.
And a monocle. You forgot the monocle. Ben Van Burden, CEO of Royal Dutch Shell. Thanks for being so cool, playing along with us here.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you very much.
And one more opinion from a CEO on where oil prices are headed comes from Bob Dudley, who's the CEO of BP.
It's been lower for longer. It's not lower forever. I think you can imagine, you were here last year at CERAWeek at this conference.
Grim.
It was very grim. No one smiled at all. The oil price was $27 a barrel. It's double that today. It's a long way from the hundreds. So the OPEC agreement in November has brought some stability back, and I think there's a real commitment to meeting that, and now the industry cost bases are restructuring.
Is that literally all it is, Bob, was the fact that OPEC decided that they were going to freeze/cut a million plus barrels, and all of a sudden everything's okay again?
No, but it puts some confidence back in. The business sees confidence, and there's stability and a commitment to keep it within a certain band here that we can make investments. BP has quietly been getting ready. 2017 is a really important year for us. We have more new projects being commissioned than ever in the history of the company. So this year is important for us, and we will see growth.
You know, we had an interview with Khalid Al-Fali. He is the Saudi oil minister, the chairman of Saudi Aramco, earlier today on CNBC. And I asked him, is the OPEC deal going to be extended past May 25th? He's obviously not going to tell us, but he said it looked good. What happens if they keep the agreement? What happens if they don't?
Well, you'd have to ask them, but
what happens to pricing?
So
your world.
If you talk to the ministers in the Gulf regions and in Russia, there's a real commitment to maintaining this. I think they will. I think they look at their own economics about it, a lower price versus cutting some production. I think the world needs an over $50 per barrel. You create social instability in a lot of places around the world. So I think it's good for the world. It's not an unnatural thing to throttle back some production, and it's going to help everybody plan.
You cut your cash costs by, I think, $7 billion over the last couple of years, but you just mentioned how big 2017 is going to be in all the projects. Is capital spending going to increase a little bit? Are we going to bring more jobs back? What's it going to look like?
Brian, we just did our strategy presentation. I just came from the East Coast. We've had teams all around the world. We're not planning on an uptick in the prices. We're going to plan on $55 to $60.
You're living in this world.
This world for the next 5 years, and we're going to live within a strict capital diet. It's down about 30% of where we were 2 or 3 years ago. We're going to live between $15 and $17 billion for the next 5 years. We can bring on these new projects within that, and we'll keep the cost down.
You've done a lot of business in Russia personally. BP owns 20% of Rosneft, one of the biggest oil companies in Russia. Do you worry about all the noise, all the tension, all the headlines around Russia right now, vis-a-vis business contracts, doing business in Russia?
I live there, I work there, I spend time there. It's a very misunderstood country when you listen to the media here. You know, I think it's a place we've been able to do business and work. It's been a very good investment for us. Our relationships are very strong. We're not just a financial investor at Rosneft. We actually work on projects with them in the country.
You sit on the board of Rosneft.
Sit on the board with Rosneft. But we have joint ventures together in and outside of Russia. And we work very much within the boundaries of the sanctions. And so we remain very committed to it. It's very successful.
Not concerned about it. You think it'll be okay going forward?
Well, I think it'll
be. It's a major part of BP's. I mean, that's 20% interest in a massive company.
That's right, yes. And so I'm very comfortable with that. And, it's what we do. It's the relationships we have and the success of the business that counts.
Bob Dudley, the CEO of BP. Coming up on The Markets, brought to you by the CME Group, Max Armstrong.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need, today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. And here is our buddy, Max Armstrong.
Monica Mooring joining us in the studio from Allendale. Well, we're getting closer and closer to spring planting time, and farmers will be ready to go. You get the feeling that the planters are ready, the equipment is ready, and once the weather allows and the calendar is appropriate, that your growers you work with will be hurrying to the field?
Yes, I do. I get the feeling that some are a little bit anxious since we've had some warmer weather here recently. So I think it will be going pretty fast once it starts.
We've seen anhydrous ammonia going on in some places. We've seen quite a bit of tillage work that took place last fall and this spring. So they should be well poised for a rapid planting pace as long as the weather at planting time permits, wouldn't you conclude?
I would say so. If we keep up with the warmer temperatures and this good weather, I don't see anything that would slow guys down.
When you take a look at some of the plain states and other parts of the Midwest, you do see a fairly significant area of dry weather. And it's been expanding a little bit, it seemed like, in the weekly drought monitor reports. How much of a concern will that be to the market if it continues to expand?
It definitely could be a concern if we don't have an El Nino pattern that sets in, as we've been talking about lately. Then that could be a real concern for some of those guys down there. It's already, like you said, very dry now. And if that continues after planting and during some of the key growing periods of the crop, that's really going to be a concern.
It has been interesting to see, Monica, how responsive the market has been to any kind of news. I mean, I'm comparing with, going back 25, 26 months ago when we were in the doldrums, when there was nothing happening, prices weren't responding at all. But it seems like anything that comes along now results in a little bit of a market response. I'm thinking, for example, of the ethanol talk, the White House ethanol talk of about 10 days ago that brought some life to the market. It just seems like the market is poised, watching for that black swan out there.
Yes, it does seem like that. That is definitely the case. The markets and the traders are definitely watching all these headlines and definitely reacting very quickly. And the funds jump on that and jump in with their buying, and off it goes. So I don't think we'll see that change anytime soon as we go through spring planting and through the summer weather as well.
I know it's a different kind of an impact on the market. It's outside of the realm of the fundamentals of supply and demand for the grains, but we're watching what the Fed is poised to do, and presumably they'll ratchet up the interest rates a little bit more. Everyone seems to think so. Does that have any market impact one way or another?
It definitely could. If they are going to raise rates next week in their meeting, then that could have an effect on the dollar index. And that could definitely affect the grain markets, whether or not there's a sharp move in the dollar either way. Since they are expected to raise rates, if they don't, that could be somewhat of a shock. And even if they do, that could be a little bit negative for the grain markets. That might cause a little bit of a spike in the dollar index.
The dollar headwinds have been pretty doggone strong since last November, it seems, as far as the grain market is concerned. And yet the demand has been amazingly strong, defying many expectations, I would think.
That's definitely true. There has been no slowdown in demand. Export sales are still very good at this time. We're still ahead of schedule from the USDA's projections for the year. So I don't at this point in time, this point in the year, sometimes there is a little bit of a slowdown once they switch to the South America's crops. So, yes, demand has been very good so far. It does tend to slow down between now and the end of the year, but it's been very good so far.
For those of us who haven't watched all that closely in recent days, the South American scene in Brazil, are they looking at both records in soybeans and corn this year potentially?
I believe they are, especially on the soybeans. We've got some numbers coming out very soon, and it seems like all the crop estimates down there keep increasing, and they're definitely on tap to have a really good crop down there. So I would not be surprised if they do have a record for both.
Corn, I guess the jury is still out because there's quite a bit of time before that crop will be harvested. Am I correct? That Safrina corn crop, they call it?
That's right. That second corn crop, yes. There's still some time for that. Correct.
Let us not forget Argentina, which became a significant market factor a year ago when they had the flooding rains. How are they looking?
They're pretty good right now. I don't think there's going to be any real concern with their crop as well. Yes, their last year, their government decisions, their new president, that was a little bit of a shock to the market, and they're changing some things around down there. But I believe their crop should be very well as well. So I don't see any problems in Argentina either.
Those rains, of course, were the big thing, I mean, 1 year ago that has surprised so many of the market when they had all of that water dumped into their fields. Talking about planting time, one thing that occurs to me is how busy your farmer customers will be when the planters are rolling. And that's a time when things can happen. Do you work with your growers even ahead of that time to say, hey, let's be a little bit prepared here in case something takes place?
Definitely. We try to be very proactive and try to get some hedging accomplished before that, so that way they don't have to think about that. They can just go out and do what they do best and plant their crops. So we definitely have plans in place, and we have lots of recommendations right now to help everybody out and to get that plan in place and just give them a little bit of peace of mind so they can go out and plant a good crop.
Have there been some marketing percentages in mind that you've been sharing with your growers in a general sense that you've been recommending to them?
We've been suggesting to pretty much hedge all of your insured bushels. We usually recommend to do that before the acreage report at the end of March, and that seems to work out very well throughout the crop year. So not a set percentage so much, but just to cover your insured bushels by that time frame.
Yeah, you reminded me. We do have a very major planting intentions report. Now, these acreage numbers will be based on actual farmer surveys, not conjecture from the USDA, not their ideas of what could be planted, but actually they will have talked to growers by then.
Yes, exactly. They will have sent out surveys to farmers, and they will have filled them out and sent them back, and we'll have some real concrete numbers as to what may be down the pipeline and what everybody's looking to plant this year.
Private estimates will be coming out before that, including the one from Allendale in the next week, I guess.
Exactly. We've got our current acreage survey going on right now. It ends on March 10th, and the results from that will be reported on March 14th, so well in advance of the USDA numbers.
What is your general feeling about how the acreage will shape up? We are anticipating a significant jump in soybean acreage. That hasn't changed, has it, in recent weeks?
No, that's still definitely the talk. Personally, my customers have not said that so much. They are going to keep mostly the same rotation. But I have heard other rumblings throughout the industry that could definitely take place.
You remind me that certainly in many areas of the Corn Belt, and I think especially the Eastern Corn Belt, growers like to keep that rotation pretty set, don't they? They get comfortable with a 50-50 balance or whatever the percentage might be. They don't like to change it too much.
Right, exactly. That's what I found over the years, is that most of my guys that I work with, they don't change the rotation very much. So they're very comfortable with that. And I think for the most part, that's what I've seen in my survey so far.
What have you sensed this winter as growers have come to meetings? Have they really been hungry for market information and sharpening their market skills, knowing just how crucial it is to market with the best, maximizing the value of that crop that you can?
Definitely, because they've seen, like you said, these market swings that we have with some of these news stories that come across, and they know how powerful the funds can be in the market as well. So they definitely realize that they need to have a handle on things. And like you said, it's very crucial to get that marketing to stay on top of that and have that in place so they can be profitable.
The market opportunity can be fleeting sometimes, can it not? Here one moment and gone the next.
Yes, most certainly. And that's, again, another reason why we like to have our hedges in place before the market gets too volatile. And with this upcoming acreage report, that's the first major report of the season. So we like to have things in place before then so we don't miss anything. We don't miss any opportunities.
Monica Mooring, thank you for being at the microphone with us this weekend. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Monica is based in central Indiana with Allendale Incorporated.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Wrapping it up for this week, the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ were all slightly lower for the week, as were gold and oil and the grain futures, lower across the board. The markets is sponsored by the CME Group. For Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong, I'm Steve Alexander.